All right, welcome in everyone to another deep dive here on the show. And today we're looking at a fascinating legal case with some pretty huge implications for anyone in legal studies, particularly those interested in disability rights, police conduct, and the way cities can be held accountable in federal court.
Definitely a lot to unpack.
Absolutely. And the case we're talking about today is Tardif v. City of New York.
That's right.
A decision from the Second Circuit back in 2012, stemming from the Occupy Wall Street protests.
Huh.
And we've got our sources here ready to go to really break down this case and what it means for the law.
Yeah, this case really offers a glimpse into how a few different legal principles kind of intersect. So we'll be exploring each of those.
So for everyone listening in today, our mission is to distill this case down into three core areas that have some pretty significant legal precedent. And to kick things off, maybe you could give us a quick rundown of those three areas.
Absolutely. So first up, we're going to look at the Americans with Disabilities Act and what it requires when you have a situation with someone with disabilities in police custody.
Okay.
Specifically, we're going to zero in on the need for a direct link between the disability and any alleged discrimination.
Gotcha. So that's the first layer. And then what's the second area we're going to be exploring?
So the second area is the legal standard used to evaluate police use of force in New York.
Okay.
We'll be comparing the concept of objective reasonableness, essentially what a reasonable officer would do, with the idea of an officer's subjective intent, like what was going on in their head. And we'll look at how that plays out when it comes to jury instructions in these cases.
So objective facts versus subjective intent.
Exactly.
Okay, fascinating stuff. And what about the third and final area we'll be examining?
All right, so the third area is a bit more complex. It's the concept of respondent superior, which basically means an employer can be held responsible for what their employees do.
Right, like holding the company liable.
Exactly. And we're going to see how that plays out in this case, especially when we're dealing with police officers who may not be identified.
Unidentified officers. Interesting wrinkle. I'm curious to see how that plays out legally.
Yeah, the case digs into how the concept of supplemental jurisdiction allowed those claims to proceed in federal court.
Oh, so there's some jurisdictional maneuvering going on there.
You got it.
Okay, cool. Well, before we get into all the legal complexities, maybe you could just paint us a picture of what happened. What led to this lawsuit in the first place?
So this case came out of the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York City back in 2012.
Right. I remember those.
The person who brought the lawsuit, Murray Tardif, was involved in those demonstrations. And really important thing to understand here is she filed two different kinds of legal claims.
Oh, so two separate tracks she was pursuing.
That's right. She had federal claims alleging that her rights were violated. And then she also had state law claims under New York law.
Okay, so like a two-pronged approach.
Exactly. And so let's break down each of those.
All right, let's do it.
So on the federal side, she argued that while she was in police custody, they delayed giving her epilepsy medication. And she claimed that violated the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Okay, so that was her first federal claim.
Right. And then she also brought claims under what's called Section 1983.
Section 1983, what's that all about?
Yeah. So for those listening who might not be familiar, Section 1983 is a federal law that allows you to sue state and local government officials if they violated your constitutional rights.
Oh, so it's a way to hold officials accountable.
Exactly. And in her section, 1983 claims Tardif alleged excessive force and deliberate indifference by the police.
Okay, so two separate 1983 claims alleging different types of misconduct. And then what about the state law claims?
Right. So at the state level, she sued two specific police sergeants for assault and battery.
So naming them directly in the lawsuit.
Exactly.
Okay, so two sets of claims, federal and state, targeting different aspects of what happened during the protest.
Precisely. And what's really interesting and really important for understanding how the rest of this case played out is that some of her federal claims actually made it past what's called summary judgment.
Summary judgment. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So summary judgment is a stage in a lawsuit where the court can actually decide the whole case or parts of it without going to a full trial.
So they make a ruling before it even goes to trial.
Exactly. And they can do that if there's no real disagreement about the important facts of the case. And the law makes it clear that one side should win.
I see. So like if the facts are undisputed and the law clearly favors one party, the court can just decide the case right then and there.
You got it. And in Tardif's case, some of her federal claims were strong enough that they survived that initial hurdle of summary judgment.
Okay. So the court said, no, these are legitimate issues that need to be explored further.
Right. And that's important because it laid the groundwork for the court to consider her other claims as well.
Oh, see, so those surviving federal claims became kind of a legal anchor, allowing the court to look at the state law claims too.
Exactly.
So let's dig into that ADA claim a little bit more. What exactly does the ADA require in these types of situations where someone with a disability is in police custody?
So Title II of the ADA says that public entities, which definitely includes cities and their police departments, have to make reasonable changes to their policies, practices, and procedures to avoid discriminating against people with disabilities.
Okay, so it's not just about individual actions.
Yeah.
It's about having systems in place that are fair to everyone.
Right, and the goal is to make sure people with disabilities have an equal chance to participate in or benefit from the city's services, programs, or whatever it might be.
So basically leveling the playing field.
Exactly.
And in Tardy's case, her argument was that delaying her epilepsy medication was a failure by the city to reasonably accommodate her disability.
That's right, but the Second Circuit ended up disagreeing with her on that point.
Why is that? What was the court's reasoning there?
The big thing that the court focused on was that there wasn't enough evidence to prove that the delay in getting her medication was specifically because of her epilepsy.
Oh, so it wasn't targeted discrimination against her because of her disability?
Right. The court looked at the evidence and thought it seemed more like just general negligence in how they handle medical requests at the detention facility, not necessarily that they were deliberately trying to discriminate against her or ignore her needs because of her epilepsy.
Interesting. So they're saying it wasn't about her disability, it was just overall sloppiness.
Right. And that's a really crucial point for anyone studying law to understand. Proving an ADA violation in these situations means you have to show a direct link between the disability and what happened, not just general incompetence or bad practices.
That because of element is really important then.
Absolutely. It's not enough to show that someone with a disability was treated poorly. You have to show that they were treated poorly specifically because of their disability.
So it has to be targeted discrimination based on that disability, not just general mistreatment.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense, but it's still a bit abstract.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a hypothetical example to illustrate that distinction.
Sure. Let's imagine a scenario where a diabetic protester is arrested and there's a long delay in getting them their insulin.
Okay, so a critical medication for a diabetic individual.
Right. And let's say that delay happens because the jail has a policy of just ignoring all medical requests for a certain amount of time, regardless of what the person's medical condition is.
So like a blanket delay for everyone?
Exactly. In that case, it would probably be seen as general negligence, not necessarily discrimination based on disability.
Because everyone's being treated the same way, regardless of their medical needs.
Right. But now let's imagine a slightly different scenario where the delay happens specifically because the jail staff doesn't understand how important it is for a diabetic person to get insulin quickly.
Oh, so they're not intentionally discriminating, but they're ignorant about the specific needs of a diabetic individual.
Precisely. Or maybe they prioritize other medical needs and kind of push the diabetic person's request to the back of the line.
So their actions are still having a discriminatory effect, even if it's not intentional.
Exactly. And in that second scenario, you'd have a much stronger argument for an ADA violation because you could say that the delay, the bad thing that happened, occurred by reason of the disability.
I see. That makes the distinction much clearer. Mm-hmm. So in the Tardif case, the court didn't find that direct link between the delay and her epilepsy.
Right. And I think that raises some questions about how specific the city's policies or training have to be to avoid running afoul of the ADA.
That's a good point. Right. So it seems like there's some gray area there about how much knowledge or awareness is required on the part of the city and its employees.
Definitely. And I think those are questions that are still being grappled with in the legal world today.
Okay, great. Well, let's move on to the second issue we wanted to discuss, which was police use of force.
Okay, sounds good.
Now, I know New York State has its own laws about when police officers are allowed to use force, right?
Yeah, that's right. New York Penal Law Section 35.31(c)(1). Basically provides a legal defense for police officers who use physical force while they're doing their jobs.
So it's saying there are times when it's okay for them to use force.
Right. It lays out the circumstances when that use of force would be considered justified.
Okay. And that's relevant here because Tardif also brought those state law claims for assault and battery against those two police sergeants, right?
Exactly. And that's where things get interesting because the whole issue of jury instructions becomes really important.
Right. You mentioned that earlier about the difference between an officer's subjective intent and the objective reasonableness of their actions.
Yeah, this is a super crucial distinction in how we think about the Fourth Amendment and police conduct.
So for everyone listening, the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is the one that protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures.
That's right. And it's really relevant here because excessive force by the police can be a violation of that Fourth Amendment, right?
Okay, so how does that play into the difference between objective and subjective standards?
So when we're evaluating whether a police officer's use of force was okay, the standard we generally use is called objective reasonableness.
Okay, break that down for us.
Basically, we're not trying to figure out what was going on in that specific officer's head at that exact moment.
Mm.
Instead, we're asking what a similarly trained and reasonable officer would have done in the same situation.
So we're creating this kind of hypothetical reasonable officer.
Exactly. And we're judging the actions based on that standard, not on the individual officer's state of mind.
So it's not about their intentions or what they personally believed. It's about whether their actions were objectively reasonable given the circumstances.
Precisely.
Okay, that makes sense. But in the Tardif case, it sounds like the trial court's instructions to the jury kind of blurred the lines between those objective and subjective standards.
Yeah, that's exactly what the Second Circuit had a problem with. The trial court told the jury to consider whether the officers believed their use of force was justified.
So it brought that element of subjective belief into the equation.
Right. And the Second Circuit said that was wrong because it introduces a subjective element into what should be a purely objective analysis.
So it could have potentially confused the jury and led them to focus on the wrong thing.
Exactly. They might have focused on what the officer was thinking instead of just looking at the situation and the officer's actions.
And the Second Circuit actually overturned the part of the verdict dealing with one of the sergeants, Sergeant Madera, specifically because of this error in the jury instructions, right?
That's right. They said it was possible the jury got it wrong because of those faulty instructions, and they ordered a new trial for that part of the case.
Okay, so one of the key takeaways here is that the way the jury is instructed can have a real impact on the outcome of the case.
Absolutely. Even a small mistake in how the jury is told to apply the law can be grounds for an appeal.
And you mentioned earlier that the outcome was different for the other sergeant, Sergeant McManus, even though the same error was made in the jury instructions.
Yeah, that's an interesting contrast, and it highlights how the specific evidence in a case can really affect how an error is treated on appeal.
So what was different about the evidence in McManus's case?
In Madera's case, there's a lot of disagreement about what actually happened during the incident.
So the facts themselves were in dispute.
Right. People were giving different accounts of what went down. And because the jury was told to consider Madera's own belief about whether his use of force was justified, the Second Circuit was worried that the jury might have put too much weight on his version of events.
Even if a more objective assessment of the situation wouldn't have supported his use of force.
Exactly. They were worried the jury might have been swayed by his subjective beliefs instead of focusing on the objective facts.
But with McManus, the situation was different, right?
Right. With McManus, the objective facts of the situation weren't really in dispute. There wasn't much disagreement about what physically happened.
So everyone was basically on the same page about the sequence of events.
Right. And because of that, the Second Circuit decided that even though the jury instruction was technically wrong, it probably didn't affect the outcome.
They're saying the jury would likely have reached the same conclusion even if they had been instructed correctly.
Exactly. Because the objective facts were so clear.
That's an interesting point. It seems like there's a bit of a judgment call involved in how these errors are analyzed on appeal.
Yeah, it's not a mechanical process. The court has to look at the whole picture and decide whether the error was harmless or whether it might have actually prejudiced the outcome.
Okay, cool. Well, let's move on to our third and final area of focus, which was the whole issue of responded superior and supplemental jurisdiction, especially in relation to those unidentified officers.
Okay, sounds good.
Now, I know this is where the procedural stuff about how the case moves through the court system starts to intersect with the actual legal issues.
Exactly. And to recap, we talked about how some of Tardif's federal claims survived summary judgment.
Right. Those were the excessive force claim against McManus and the deliberate indifference claims against Rumble and Schmidt.
Right. And those surviving federal claims are what allowed the federal court to consider Tardif's state law claims as well.
And that's because of this thing called supplemental jurisdiction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Supplemental jurisdiction is what gives a federal court the power to hear state law claims that normally wouldn't belong in federal court.
So it's like expanding the court's reach to encompass these related state claims.
Yeah. You got it. And the key requirement is that the state law claims have to be closely related to the federal claims that are already in the lawsuit.
So it can't just be any random state law claim. It has to be connected to the federal issues.
Right. They have to arise from the same basic set of facts, the same events.
And that's what allows the federal court to kind of package them all together and hear them all at once.
Exactly. It makes things more efficient and avoids having to have two separate lawsuits in two different court systems.
Right. That makes sense. So how did this idea of supplemental jurisdiction allow Tardif to bring those claims against the city for the actions of unidentified officers?
Okay, so remember, Tardif alleged that she was assaulted by some NYPD officers during her arrest on March 21st, but she couldn't identify those specific officers.
Right, they were John Doe's in the lawsuit.
Exactly. And then she also had those surviving federal claims related to her detention on April 16th, where she alleged they were deliberately indifferent to her medical needs.
Right. Two separate incidents separate in time.
Right. And the court had to figure out whether those two sets of events were connected closely enough to justify using supplemental jurisdiction.
So whether the assault during the arrest and the medical indifference during the detention were part of the same basic controversy.
Exactly. And in this case, the court said, yes, they were connected.
Even though it was different officers and different dates.
Right. And they focused on the fact that both incidents stemmed from Tardif's involvement in the Occupy Wall Street protests and her interactions with the NYPD.
So it was all part of the same overall sequence of events.
Precisely. And they also emphasized that both incidents allegedly caused Tardif psychological harm.
So there was a common thread of harm running through both incidents.
Exactly. And that was enough for the court to say that those claims were sufficiently related to justify using supplemental jurisdiction.
Interesting. So even though the incidents were distinct, they were still part of the same larger story.
That's right.
And that's what allowed Tardif to bring those state law claims against the city, even though she couldn't identify the specific officers involved in the earlier incident.
Exactly. The court basically said, look, the city can't just escape responsibility by saying we don't know which officers did it.
So it's a way of holding the city accountable, even when the individual officers can't be identified.
Right. And that's a really important principle that comes out of this case, especially for anyone interested in police accountability and civil rights litigation.
I could see how that would be a powerful tool in cases where there's evidence of misconduct, but the specific officers are unknown.
Exactly. It prevents cities from just throwing up their hands and saying it's not our problem.
Right. It closes that loophole, so to speak.
Precisely.
Okay. Well, I think this has been a really fascinating and informative deep dive into a complex case. And I'm wondering, as we wrap up, if you could just highlight a few of the key takeaways for our listeners, especially those who are thinking about going into law.
Sure. So I think one of the big takeaways from this case is the importance of strategic pleading.
What does that mean exactly?
It means when you're drafting your complaint, when you're first laying out your legal arguments, you need to think about all the different angles and make sure you're covering all your bases.
So like anticipating potential challenges and making sure your arguments are strong enough to withstand those challenges.
Right. And in this case, that meant specifically making sure those state law claims were clearly articulated right from the start and that the potential for respondent superior liability was clearly laid out.
So basically setting yourself up for success later down the road.
Exactly. And then another important takeaway is that cities can't always avoid being held responsible for police misconduct just because they don't know which officers were involved.
Right. We talk about that with the unidentified officers.
Exactly. And the Tardif case shows that if the alleged misconduct is connected to other viable federal claims, the city could still be on the hook under respondent superior.
So it's a reminder to cities that they need to have good systems in place for identifying and addressing misconduct, even when it's not immediately clear which officers were involved.
Absolutely. And I think the third big takeaway is that the objective reasonableness standard is really important when we're talking about police use of force.
Right. We talked about that in detail.
And the Tardif case reinforces that the focus should be on the objective facts, not on the officer's subjective beliefs.
So it's about what a reasonable officer would have done in that situation, not what that particular officer was thinking or feeling.
Exactly. And that has big implications for how police officers are trained and how police departments are run.
It sets a clear standard for what's acceptable and what's not.
Precisely.
Okay, awesome. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. And for those of you listening who are thinking about a career in the law, I think this case offers a lot of food for thought.
Definitely. It really gets at some of the fundamental tensions in our legal system between individual rights and government power.
And how those tensions play out in real-world situations.
Exactly. And I think the Tardif case is a reminder that those tensions are always present and that lawyers have a crucial role to play in navigating them.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me for another deep dive into the law.
My pleasure.
I hope everyone listening found this informative and thought-provoking. And be sure to tune in next time for more legal insights and analysis.
See you next time.
Bye for now.